Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, October 19th, is the day the American Revolution essentially ended in 1781, with the surrender of British General Cornwallis at Yorktown, Virginia. His troops marched into history with its band playing a popular melody, "The World Turned Upside Down." Today is also the 50th anniversary of my discharge from the United States Marine Corps following a year in Vietnam. The Vietnam War is our bad conscience and will not let go its stranglehold on American national memory despite every effort to deny or discount it. Perhaps that is why the war is generally referred to as Vietnam, a subliminal acknowledgement that the USA attempted, but failed, to eradicate an ancient culture as being not only inferior, but inconsequential to a declared larger purpose in which Vietnam and its people were abstract and annoying Cold War pawns. The entire country, north and south, was a free fire and bomb zone. Every Vietnamese was suspected of being enemy. The dead were obviously enemy. Viet Cong or VC sympathizers, or they would not be dead. Standard operating procedure was shoot first, body count later. At least 2 million young American men and women were sent into the decade-long war, infused with second-rate propaganda, racist and political, and afterward abandoned to their nightmares and moral struggles if they survived. The tragedy of the war was that Vietnamese civilians were killed intrinsically or were executed. Both types of incidents were prevalent in Vietnam. The first a general occurrence, the second not as common. Yet the relative nonchalance of the My Lai massacre by American soldiers is evidence that obliterating villages and their inhabitants was not infrequent. The resurgence of controversy about the Vietnam War, enhanced by the recent Vietnam War TV series by Ken Burns, thwarts the deliberate obscuration of the war, and it rekindles old antagonisms. Ultimately, the arguments about the war and national culpability for killing Vietnamese civilians is between those who have long supported America's involvement in the war and those who have equally as long been opposed to it. It also underscores the deep misunderstanding and animosity between those who have experienced war and those who have not. Today's program commemorates the 50th anniversary of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I joined up in the winter of 1968, 6 months after my discharge from the USMC. A few of us also became veterans of the officially designated police riot at the Chicago Democratic Convention that summer. Next month, on Armistice Day 99, the Vietnam Wall, which was conceived by Vietnam veterans and designed by Maya Lin, will be 35. So I'm going to read something about the VVAW, which I wrote, and I call it Winter Soldiers. And I start with a quote by U.S. Army General William Tecumseh Sherman. "I am sick and tired of war. Its glory is all moonshine. It is only those who have never fired a shot nor heard the shrieks and groans of the wounded who cry aloud for blood, more vengeance, more desolation and destruction. War is cruel, and you cannot refine it. War is hell." At some point in time, although the killing did not stop, the war in Vietnam was declared over. The last American soldiers came home. One of them wrote on a wall at Saigon's Tansanut Airport, "Will the last American please turn out the light at the end of the tunnel?" There never was a light, only a long tunnel into which millions disappeared, among them nearly 60,000 Americans. Another 300,000 were wounded, thousands of them returning without legs, arms, or genitals. Thousands more were paralyzed, physically and psychologically. They came back singly at first, random leaves scattered by military winds throughout the country. For the greater part of the decade of massive escalation that swallowed American troops into Southeast Asia, hundreds of thousands of young men went to war and returned daily, almost without notice. The dead and wounded returned unseen. The wounded overflowed U.S. military hospitals in Asia and Europe. The most critically injured eventually flown to stateside hospitals near their homes where possible. But more likely, they wound up in VA hospitals too poorly funded and understaffed to adequately care for them. The dead came back and invisibly crossed the country in the mail cars of trains or baggage compartments of airplanes. Rarely have the soldiers of an American army slunk as quietly back home from a war, desiring for the most part to be left in obscurity. In previous wars, they came back to parades and exultant crowds. Even the defeated Confederate army, broken and tattered, maintained a bitter, noble pride that hardly gave ground to northern carpetbaggers. Veterans of war similar to Vietnam, the so-called Philippine insurrection, the Caribbean banana wars, never felt a need to justify their participation in unpopular wars, as did many Vietnam veterans. Although the vets were probably never spit upon, the continuing popularity of the myth that they were is a template of Vietnam's unpopularity, as well as open scorn for its soldiers. Five presidents and 12 Congresses tried to keep the Vietnam War from upsetting the citizenry. They promised guns and butter while taking the country's sons and money. They lied about the war from the beginning, when the French fell at Dien Bien Phu in May 1954 until the fall of Saigon on the last day of April 1975. Night after night, the American public was numbed to the war by the artifice of television news. Yet few ever saw any of their war dead. The sight of dead or wounded Americans was considered bad for morale. Death was edited out, at least for U.S. dead. The war was computed on body counts of dead Vietnamese. Only once in all those years did the veterans become visible enough to be heard, and it was in dissent against the war, when 1,000 combat survivors gathered in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 1971 and hurled their war medals at Congress. Vietnam veterans have been pitied more as pliant fools or for pathological tendencies that they are honored than they are honored in the old traditional manner. Raised voices insist Vietnam veterans are either heroes and patriots or butchers and baby killers. They returned to a country that did not understand them, a society that was embarrassed and disturbed by them. They were comparable in that sense to the draft resistors who chose prison or exile rather than fight in the war, and to the deserters who either refused to be shipped overseas or chose exile after they returned. Ironically, it was the veterans, not the five presidential administrations and 12 Congresses, that created and continued the war for almost two decades, who were held responsible for the tragic debacle in Southeast Asia. They were shunned as a nation's scapegoats, as if they were personally responsible for the disastrous policies and failed strategies that lost the war. The reality of Vietnam's consequences goes beyond the suffering of its soldiers or the Vietnamese with whom they are so intimately linked in terror, shame, and death. Vietnam veterans do not represent a lost war so much as they are the nation's conscience in an affair in which the nation refused for too long to act morally against a pervasive and systematic destruction of a people and a culture considered inferior and of merely strategic consideration, and as a result eroded much of its own integrity. The Vietnam War was ambiguous and off-center. Like Korea, it was a low-stakes war, more bluff than real cards in a worldwide Cold War that threatened nuclear oblivion, though hundreds of thousands of real persons perished and anonymous millions were handicapped for life, psychologically as well as physically. Vietnam unearthed a deadly rot at the core of the nation's history, and its corrupt and defeated consequences continue to haunt an America once again falsely drawn into war by its leaders. In societies that wish to quickly forget a war or obscure its purpose, surviving soldiers are more apparent in their grim visibility. Returning soldiers are carriers of the disease of conscience and are more likely to be shunned rather than embraced. Many retreat into alcohol and drugs, react violently and bitterly to criticism. They are restless and often unable to hold a job or maintain a romance. A few openly repudiate the war in which they fought. A small but significant number of Vietnam veterans organized to stop the war, which immediately triggered a pro-war military and political jihad. Neither pro-war nor anti-war initially accepted or acknowledged the Vietnam veterans against the war. The anti-war accused the veterans of indiscriminate murder and of being pro-fascist personalities. They originally condemned the veterans as baby killers, an unforgiving phrase the veterans have not forgiven. The right wing, particularly such established veterans groups as the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars, assailed the VVAW as traitors and or as veteran impersonators. The anti-war movement at first rejected anti-war veterans as hopelessly guilty for having served in Vietnam in the first place. Veterans were slowly, grudgingly accepted, initially as confessed lepers, to otherwise be avoided socially and politically, ultimately as the vanguard of anti-war activities. the attitude of the pro-war right has not changed. The VVAW even now is accused of aiding North Vietnamese as a result of its opposition to the war. The VVAW was started in the fall of 1967. The idea for the organization began during a massive anti-war demonstration in New York City that April. Six veterans marched with a large banner proclaiming Vietnam veterans against the war. The same banner was carried by other veterans at the Pentagon in October that year for the gigantic March Against Death. One of the vets on that march, Jan Barry Crum, who was a U.S. Army advisor in South Vietnam in 1963 and later quit West Point in protest to the war in his second year, envisioned the VVAW as an outgrowth of the banner's slogan. Soldiers and veterans then as now were used as propaganda against the anti-war movement. Hardly any acknowledgement of veterans opposing the war was made publicly until the VVAW led protest against the American Legion at its annual convention in Portland, Oregon, in the summer of 1970. National media found the contrast irresistible, a newer era of veterans counterposed to veterans of an earlier era, which at the time was rather unprecedented. Life magazine ran a full-page photograph of an American Legionnaire sitting next to an ex-Army medic member of VVAW to confirm the contrariety. The unequivocal purpose of VVAW was to end the war and bring U.S. troops home from overseas. To that end, VVAW held two war crimes inquiries to publicly make clear the war's deception, immorality, and decimation of Vietnamese as a people and culture, but also the threat to American values the war was allegedly being fought for. The testimonies, named Winter Soldier Investigations, in contrast to Thomas Paine's jibe at Sunshine Patriots, were held in Washington, D.C. in December 1970 and Detroit, Michigan in February 1971. Winter Soldier was a response to the slaughter of Vietnamese civilians at My Lai in 1968, but only publicly revealed the previous year. The veterans hoped to show that although an army platoon had killed more people in a single place, the attitude toward Vietnamese, generated by fear, racism, and revenge, that led to My Lai, was universal throughout Vietnam and the war. By the mandate of Nuremberg, military men and women are required to speak out against war crimes and other forms of injustice and wrongdoing within the military. It is usually next to impossible to do so without isolation and punishment while in uniform, and the great majority of those in Vietnam waited, in the VVAW, pardon me, waited until they were free of the military. Many in uniform were heartened by VVAW as a result and took a chance to speak out against Vietnam despite the risks. For most of the veterans who testified, it was the first time they had recounted their experiences in Vietnam, and for nearly all of them, it was the first opportunity they had to listen to the experiences of others who had done virtually the same things over a decade of war. The most important factor was the redundancy, the same genocidal pattern linked by men whose service in Vietnam spanned the period of American involvement. It was the first time the whole puzzle pieced itself together for each one of them, most of whom had spent not much more than a single year in country. More than 100 vets testified for 3 days. They told of genocide, psychological and physical, of forced urbanization of peasants from villages, of burning and pillaging hundreds upon hundreds of villages, of wholesale defoliation of jungles and fields, of indiscriminate bombing with napalm and high fragmentation bombs, of harassment and interdiction fire by artillery at night with no particular targets, just shooting up the countryside to instill fear and carnage. And they told of free fire zones where everything that moved was fair game to be killed, no questions asked. Winter Soldier emerged as a terse elaboration of American policy in Vietnam through the combined narratives of the soldiers who carried it out. But no one seemed to listen. The news media, for the most part, embargoed their testimony. What coverage they received was vicarious and quietly sensational in its limited coverage, calling them alleged veterans, though all of them presented their documents of legitimacy. Detractors who attended the hearings called them phonies, cowards, and traitors. The Pentagon denied their accusations and put the burden of proof as well as guilt as specific war criminals upon the vets. Oregon Senator Mark Hatfield defied criticism and had the testimonies inserted into the congressional record. Anti-war veterans' movements have been virtually unnoticed in American history, yet that history abounds with veterans taking arms against their military masters from the very start. Former colonial veterans of the French and Indian War fought against their old army and set up a republic 2 centuries ago. The army split down the middle in 1861, and comrade fought comrade for 4 immensely bloody years until the Union was restored. There have undoubtedly been countless such revolts against military hierarchies, however limited in scope and action, whether or not successful. With the exception of renegade officers leading military coups and setting up dictatorships, the actions of soldiers turning against their nation's military in the name of peace and anti-militarism have largely gone unknown. In that context, it would seem that the only combat veteran in Western history known to attempt the philosophical collapse of militarism was Socrates. If there has ever existed a well-researched and documented history of rebellion within military institutions objecting to militarism and the ethic of war, it has been well hidden. Yet the fact is that revolt within the military machine is an enduring tradition in itself. Just as radical opposition has always existed at the core of every political system, so it has inside every military arm of those systems. Within this tradition of revolt can be understood both the roots and vacuum of the rebellion against the Vietnam War by a number of its veterans. The roots lie in the constant insurrection throughout military history. The vacuum exists in the suppression of that history. Vietnam veterans who opposed the war had to start from scratch with little workable knowledge of precedent in what they attempted. Yet because they were left to their own imaginations, the members of VVAW instigated the most significant revolt against war by war veterans in American history. Vietnam veterans poured into Washington, D.C. from all over the country in April 1971 for Operation Dewey Canyon III, named after 2 ill-starred military operations conducted by U.S. Marines and Saigon troops in Vietnam and Laos. VVAW vets occupied and held a stretch of public park in front of the U.S. Capitol despite a Supreme Court ban. Their actions got worldwide media attention. They invaded Congress with demands to end the war based on their winter soldier testimonies. They held guerrilla theater every day throughout the city, dressed in fatigues and brandishing plastic toy M16 rifles. Shut out of Arlington National Cemetery, they went back and were let in. The Nixon administration denied they were veterans, and they proved to the media they were with military discharge papers. Ordered off the mall by the Supreme Court, they refused to go, inspiring newspaper headlines such as, "Vets overrule Supreme Court." Several hundred active duty soldiers standing riot duty in Washington, many of them Vietnam vets, threatened to join the VVAW vets if their units were mobilized against them. On the last day of Dewey Canyon III, more than 1,000 vets threw their war medals at the Capitol steps. One active duty Army lieutenant showed up to add the decorations of several officers, including his commanding colonel. Overnight, VVAW became national heroes. From then on, the VVAW was acknowledged as a respected, loyal opposition by Americans, whether in support or opposed to the war. None of VVAW's demands toward ending the war were directly met, nor were expected to be. The main objective was to make their presence known to the American public, which they quite obviously accomplished. Following Dewey Canyon III, more than 500,000 people marched against the war in Washington, D.C., almost the exact number of Americans serving in Vietnam at that time, while several thousand marched simultaneously in San Francisco. Then came May Day, in which demonstrators from every state attempted to shut down the government, hundreds of whom were arrested and pinned up in sports stadiums imitating South American despots. 20 VVAW members penetrated police and military defenses around the Pentagon and hurled bags of freshly gathered chicken scat on the front steps and were arrested for chicken defecation distribution, one of them said. Dewey Canyon III was the high water mark of the VVAW. The last VVAW actions of national prominence were occupation of the Statue of Liberty by New York vets in early 1972 and participation in demonstrations that summer at the Republican National Convention in Miami, Florida. The government decided to judicially destroy VVAW and prosecuted veterans who were at the GOP convention, muzzling all publicity that might help their case. But as it turned out, the government depended on its own agents provocateur as witnesses against the vets. The defense predicated its case on those very same witnesses' testimony of infiltration and provocation, and the jury quickly acquitted the defendants. VVAW did a number of other things besides oppose the war. It provided help for war wounded and traumatized vets who had no one else they felt they could trust. Even if they might not oppose the war, they sought the counseling and companionship of Vietnam rap groups inaugurated by VVAW long before the Veterans Administration recognized what was then called post-Vietnam syndrome, now PTSD. VVAW researched the effects of Agent Orange as well as other toxic defoliants sprayed upon U.S. troops and Vietnamese, and helped bring so far unsuccessful lawsuits against the government and chemical companies. The original organizers and initial members of Vietnam Veterans for America, or of America, I beg your pardon, which among many other activities sponsored the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C., were drawn from VVAW. Armistice Day this year is the 35th anniversary of the Vietnam War. VVAW deactivated before the Vietnam War ended. It had failed its quest to end the war, yet notably contributed to its end by defiantly acting on the collective belief that no one knows about a war better than its veterans. By the time the counterfeit government of South Vietnam collapsed and the last American left Saigon in 1975, VVAW seemed to have disappeared. Yet when VVAW had been consigned to history as a single-issue aberration, its opponents and critics undoubtedly hoped would never recur, newer wars in Central America in the 1980s and the Persian Gulf War in the 1990s forced the apostate veterans out of languishment, and VVAW reemerged in response, recruiting newer generations of disaffected veterans. VVAW remains in existence with a solid cadre nationally of original and new members, and once again publishes its own newspaper, The Veteran, as successor to the Vietnam GI, which died with its editor-publisher, Jeff Charlotte, an early victim of Vietnam-induced disease. VVAW received nearly as much attention 3 decades after the fall of Saigon as a result of John F. Kerry's candidacy for President of the USA in 2004 as it once had when it was actively opposed to the Vietnam War. Spurious accusations were made about VVAW to discredit Kerry, who emerged as a principal spokesman for VVAW following his return from Vietnam as a Navy lieutenant, and they were for the most part as trite as they were untrue. Among caustic allegations made about the VVAW is that it was communist-inspired, or at least infiltrated by communists. It actually was infiltrated with Quantum's more undercover agents from nearly every government agency in the country, from CIA, FBI, to local police moles. Another canard was that VVAW was bankrolled by multiple choice, Moscow and or Red China. Jane Fonda, with whom the right wing has a very unhealthy, even psychotic fixation. Various left-wing terrorist groups. Most VVAW vets would say their personal participation in terrorism ended with discharge from the military. And perhaps by even Ho Chi Minh himself, who died in 1969, 6 years before his dream of reuniting Vietnam became real. Perhaps the most onerous aspersion against VVAW was the matter of possible political assassination some of its members discussed, perhaps endorsed. Pro-war politicians as well as war profiteers were allegedly targeted, but in each instance the notion was turned down. The fact that such proposals were discussed has more to do with the fact many of these men were adept in killing, despite spurious claims that VVAW was made up primarily of rear echelon veterans. To the contrary, a great many, even a majority, were combat vets. How else to explain the crippled, armless, and legless vets who were at Dewey Canyon 3? Whenever a prospect of assassination might have been discussed, it was probably dismissed as impassively as it was thought about. VVAW was not a Boy Scout troop. Its membership consisted of killers whose most intense purpose was to stop the killing, even if it sometimes they thought about killing as a means of ending it. Some of the former killing machines thought violence a reasonable option as well as assassination, but others said, as emphatic truth, we don't do that anymore. John Reed, Oregon's most notorious writer, 10 Days That Shook the World, saw the sinister side of soldiers and anticipated the civic consequence of military rule. "I hate soldiers," he wrote. "I hate to see a man with a bayonet on his rifle who can order me off the street. I hate to belong to an organization that is proud of being a caste of superior beings, that is proud of killing free ideas so that it can more effectively kill human beings." And that was John Reed. That is not the currently popular attitude toward members of the armed forces. It is, however, a historically accurate one. The very troops we are exhorted to love and cherish can be turned against us, ordered to suppress dissent and round up political activists. The chilling thought is that in times like these, such repressive acts could have popular support, at least initially, as happened during the Vietnam War, with the use of police and National Guards. National security is boilerplated over the Constitution. Vietnam taught us that a war cannot long continue without popular support. That can be provocation for rallying around a flag and tying it with a yellow ribbon. It is a better argument for refusing to endorse a war so that it might quickly end or perhaps never begin. The war parties always attempt to capture patriotism as their own and portray dissent against their wars as sedition and disloyalty. But dissent is necessary. It is the true act of patriotism, and it is a more reasonable way to support the troops than sending them into horror. This is Michael McCusker, former USMC 167-1684. Today is Independence Day for me and for the USA.